Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. Now, in this episode, I'm joined by my good friend and host of Punch Card Investing, which is a weekly live stream show on YouTube that I'm a part of, for anyone who's not following along with that already, of course, Jack Duffley. Now, Jack was on the podcast almost exactly 2 years ago. I don't know why I leave it so long between drinks to get some of these people back on the podcast, but it was great to have Jack back. It was interesting looking back at what we actually chatted through a couple of years ago. Jack was building up his real estate portfolio at the time. He was also starting to get into more sort of quantitative style value investing, running Joel Greenblatt's Magic Formula strategy, for example, which is actually a portfolio he mentioned he does still have. But Jack's gone through quite a big shift in terms of how he allocates his personal capital in the past couple of years. He's now working full-time as real estate attorney, and he's actually invested a lot of his personal capital into a local private business in Houston, where he now lives. So it was very interesting to talk through that journey with Jack and why he made the decision to invest in and also start running basically a private business. We also talked through how that's changed his view on both real estate investing and stock market investing. He's making some adjustments there basically to free up some more capital to do more private business investing. And we also put a few questions to Jack from the audience towards the end of the episode. So this was a fun conversation to have with Jack. We do talk pretty frequently on Punch Card Investing each week, but it was nice to have sort of a one-on-one and delve a bit deeper into some of these topics. So I really hope you enjoy the episode, but without further ado, let's roll this one with Jack Duffley. Jack, Mr. Business, Mr. Houston King Steam Cleaner, Duffley returns to the podcast.
Wow.
Jack, it's been, I think, almost exactly 2 years since you've been on the podcast. So I'm very excited to have you back. How are you today?
I mean, I talk to you every week, Tom. So 2 years, you know, we talk every week over on the world famous Punch Card Investing show. So that's always a good time, but I'm doing all right. And, I guess you've crowned me king, apparently, so I appreciate that. Of course. How have things been for you, new dad? You're just over a month now, right? How's that been?
Yeah, 6 weeks in, I had a pretty good sleep last night. I think a couple of podcast episodes ago, I was sitting here saying I didn't have a very good sleep at all, and that may affect me mentally, but I should be good for this one.
You're seasoned.
Although you're the one that's going to get the hard-hitting questions here, Jack. So
sure.
I should.
You don't need to be on. I
sleep you're getting at night. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I just gotta read off the handful of questions I have written down and we're away. And I tremendous. Should say, you will be another year older probably by the time this episode goes out. But it's your birthday here in New Zealand as we record this. Not quite your birthday where you're sitting, but an early happy birthday to you.
So. I appreciate it. Yes, I'll be 26 tomorrow here in the States, though. 26 in New Zealand in my alternative universe over there, whatever you guys do.
Yeah, I don't know how that works.
Yeah,
all good. Let's get into it, Jack. Like I say, it's been a couple of years since we chatted here on the just the two of us on the podcast. Although we did have just two of us on Punch Card.
We did.
It seemed like people enjoyed that. I don't really know why, but we'll take it.
we had some supporters. I definitely felt good about myself.
Yeah, for sure. And I was looking back at what we talked through last time we recorded. The title for the episode was about real estate investing and also the magic formula, like Joel Greenblatt's sort of quantitative stock investing strategy. I would say things have probably changed quite a bit for you in those past couple of years in terms of what you're doing with your personal finance journey, how you're approaching investing these days. Do you want to give us like a quick recap as best you can on what's happened in the past couple of years? Because I think you've also become a full-time attorney probably in that time as well. Maybe for anyone that doesn't watch Punch Card, which hopefully that's no one, but just in case no one watches Punch Card and hasn't come across you before, how about you introduce yourself very briefly?
Yeah, quick note, I do still have the Magic Formula portfolio, so that is still going. So it's a very little nice. Tiny experimental portfolio in an IRA I have. It's our retirement accounts here in the States. But anyways, I'm Jack Duffley. Tom just gave me a very warm, amazing intro, calling me the king of what was it, steam and carpet cleaning here in Houston. And that's because I recently bought a business here in Houston that does steam and carpet cleaning. And that's been my most recent venture. And that's really been part of an overarching kind of journey in the last couple of years, where I've kind of shifted away from, we'll call it more passive, defensive style investing into real estate, stocks, and all that stuff, and more into privately held businesses where I'm trying to take over 100% of the business. So far, I've only got one. So I'm saying businesses like it's plural, but not quite yet. But that's really been what I've been focusing all my investing in. Meanwhile, during the day, I'm a full-time commercial real estate attorney for a big law firm here in Houston. I moved from Chicago to Houston in this past year as well, so that was a big change too. And I'm still at the same firm I was at then. They have an office in both cities. I think that's a decent synopsis. Probably should have tightened that a bit, but hopefully that's a great place to start.
Yeah, no, that's very good. Well, I mean, maybe talk us through some of the reasons why you've made some of those changes, you know, going from real estate and stock investing into private businesses. That's what I'm really keen to pick your brain on for this episode. So do you want to give us a bit of background on, I guess, why you started looking at a private business in the first place and kind of where you're at now?
Yeah, to that, actually, just this week, and I'll be putting out a video on my own channel the day after we're filming this. So on my actual birthday, every month on the first, I do a net worth breakdown and talk about what's kind of going on in the last month. And I actually sold all of my publicly traded stocks outside. I should say I sold all of my public stocks that are outside of my retirement accounts. So I had about $100,000, which is technically was all my net worth. But I have a lot more in assets because of a bunch of real estate debt. But it's a significant portion of my assets were in publicly traded stocks. I removed all those, turned them into cash right now. I'm going to find a role for them very soon, or at least so I think. But the reason I'm doing that and I'm liquidating part of my portfolio to roll it into things like private businesses, into my existing business I now have and into new ones in the future, ideally, is for a few reasons. For one, just cheapness overall. A lot of small businesses here in the US are surprisingly cheap. And I really never thought of it up until basically this last year when I started really looking into it closely. But you can pick up a business for 1 to 2 times free cash flow that's had pretty steady cash flow over the past however many years and go from there versus something like a publicly traded stock that if you're looking at a cheap one might be 5 times free cash flow, maybe 10, but you know, it's significantly cheaper. Of course, there are plenty of drawbacks too. You're taking over something that you now need to run, and there's a risk that you're not good at that, of course. So I don't mean to minimize that, but that's one reason. It's cheaper. Two, the second reason is I really want to focus on increasing my income in a significant way. And I see a lot of those publicly traded stocks, real estate, as a lot more defensive. And there's a great role for them. You want to park your money there to preserve it, grow it a bit, ideally a bit over inflation. And it's a great way to preserve wealth. It's usually pretty tax efficient as well. But compare that to something like a private business where you own everything, you probably have a lot more upside that is directly part of your control, assuming you run things well, of course. So that's the ultimate caveat in all this is you got to run it well. So there's a lot of cash flow upside. And I want to get that income up to a level to where I could then have a lot more to invest so that when I invest it, it really moves the needle in a big way. Because right now, if I were to invest $100,000, let's say I have a great year and I make 25% or something like that. Well, that's $25,000. It's great. I would take it for sure, but it's not really moving the needle in a huge way. I want to get well beyond that. So instead of focusing on all my time and energy and effort towards trying to get an extra few percent on my otherwise pretty small portfolio, I'd rather find a way to reinvest it into myself, into my own businesses, and try and find a way to boost my income that way. So those are the main two reasons. And then the third is just the growth and learning that comes with trying to run a team and in building that portfolio, which should make me a better investor in the long term as well. So long as I'm taking the right lessons from it, of course, which is a pretty key distinction. So very I think cool. That answers the question. Those are kind of the three big reasons. And there are other things, I suppose, but those are the ones that really come top of mind.
And do you see buying private businesses as something that you can scale up a lot? Like, will you continue rolling into new ones? You know, if you're buying things at 2 or 3 years worth of cash flow, are you gonna kind of be growing at 30 to 50% a year, just like constantly reinvesting the cash flow? Or how do you kind of think about that?
That's a good question. That's one of the most significant limitations with this strategy is that it's a lot harder to scale when you're taking 100% ownership of these small businesses, many of which might be in a pretty boring industry. At least that's what I'm looking at right now. Carpet cleaning, for example, it's very much a commoditized business. The total market cap you're probably going to get on a carpet cleaning business isn't that enormous unless you're trying to do something like a franchise model and spread it all across the country or something like that, which I'm not nearly at that position yet, if, assuming it's even something I'll ever do. But the scalability is a lot more limited because of all the control issues and having to delegate things. Whereas that's the key advantage with stocks and more passive investments in that you just fire and forget. You put the money into the thing and you let the other people run it. That's great. But with that, your upside's probably quite a bit limited. So that's how I think about it. And right now, because of the size of my portfolio, I think it makes sense to just go for these more concentrated bets. Where I see more upside now. And yes, I would like to keep rolling it into new businesses, in addition to reinvesting into the existing businesses that I'd already have, to try and grow them that way. And I don't know what the exact size or number of businesses will be. It just kind of depends. I'd like to have some cross-pollination, if you will, between the businesses. I think home services would be a great thing for me to focus on right now because I already have the carpet steam cleaning arms of the business. We'd like to add duct cleaning at some point as well, power washing. And then maybe from there, you had pool servicing. You can add a lot of things just within the home services niche. And those are all plenty viable businesses right there. And then you could kind of combine them in a way or so, otherwise have cross-pollination between them. That'd be a nice way. Create a sort of ecosystem. And that could make it really nice for if I get back in real estate in earnest, you'd have a nice whole service-based industry at your fingertips that could help kind of service those things. But that's a very long-term kind of vague goal. But the number one goal is just to find good deals. And if I can find good deals in and around the spaces I'm already in, that's great. If I want to diversify outside of them, it just has to make sense. And I have to be careful not to just overextend myself, which is the number one challenge, especially while working a full-time job.
How do you balance running the business against your full-time job? Like, do you view yourself getting more into your basically like business management role over time, or do you still plan to continue being a lawyer for a long period of time? How are you thinking about that?
Well, yeah, I'm still a lawyer right now. And it is difficult. I don't have I'm not, you're the father here. I'm not. So I have a little bit of extra time on my hands just because of that. But I do envision having more and more of my time spent towards this venture at least, or this venture of private business ownership. And that's part of the reason I've sold off my stocks. And I'm actually in the middle of selling one of my rental properties as well, or I'm about to. The plan is to list it in the coming weeks, both as a way to raise cash and also just minimize potential distractions that maybe aren't paying me as much as one of these more lucrative opportunities might be in the private business space. So that's part of the consolidation effort. And one thing I'm actually exploring with my job is lowering my hours. And nothing's totally in motion yet, but I know that is a thing that the firm I work for offers, and plenty of people do those sorts of arrangements, be it permanent or temporary. So that is something I'm exploring just as the team grows, looking to hire people, quite a few people in the coming few months, mainly on the sales side of things. So that's just going to be more to manage, should have a lot more upside. That's a lot more scalable than a W-2 job, but we got a lot of debt to worry about. And I think it makes sense to keep that salary job for a pretty long time. And I wouldn't even consider leaving it unless I was making some serious cash. With the private businesses, which, maybe that'll happen sooner rather than later. But for now, I'm still a full-time practicing attorney, and I will be for the foreseeable future.
Can you talk us through what the process of buying a private business looked like? Because I know you were you were sort of hunting for one for quite a while and kicked the tires on a few. What did the process look like from, you know, the idea going in your head of maybe I want to buy a private business to looking at them, to making an offer, to financing them, to getting them across the line, to taking it over? Like, it seems like quite the process you kind of went through. Can you talk us through that?
It's really not as complicated as it might seem. I suppose it depends on what kind of business you're buying. But for, you know, a business that's doing a couple hundred grand in sales, especially like a service-based business, it's really, especially compared to analyzing a $500 million market cap company with multiple business divisions and multiple countries, like, you know, that's I think it's a lot simpler if you're somewhat familiar with business analysis, which I did find quite helpful just in looking at public stocks and real estate deals over the past few years. It made it a lot easier. So it was great practice for that. And then similarly, looking at these private deals is good practice for looking at public stocks as well. So it's it goes both ways. But I think the hardest part of the process was just narrowing what industries or what companies or what businesses to focus on, because there's just so many out there. I didn't realize like the scope and depth of all these different industries you can get into. One of the weirdest ones I looked at was a glass blowing business. There was some real estate involved, so I was interested because of that. The price was quite cheap once you factored in the value of the real estate. So be kind of like a combination real estate deal plus business, and there's quite a few of those as well. But there's glass blowing, any sort of restaurant concept you could possibly think of, all the different types of home service businesses out there. Did anything you can think of, there's probably something within some radius of your location, at least in the States, but I imagine in most of the free world. So that's the hardest part, trying to narrow it down. And as I kind of went through the exercise of looking at all these businesses, I think I came to the conclusion that I should focus on a simple service-based business, something that you don't have to be a rocket scientist to run. Maybe the upside is quite a bit less than if I was in some more moaty sort of business that's harder for competition to break into. But at the same time, it really doesn't take a whole lot to make what really amounts to life-changing money with a service-based business that's been done many times before. Somehow you have all these players in the space right now in your local area. You know, how many power washing companies are there? How many carpet cleaning companies are there? I know of a handful already that are doing a few million dollars each here in Houston. And it's not like there isn't room for you to take some slice of that otherwise very large pie just in the local area. And you don't need it to be $100 million company to make a lot of money. You could be doing a couple million dollars top line. That would be a fantastic result, and that would be life-changing money right there. So, in that way, I guess it kind of depends on your goals. If you are looking to build a billion-dollar business, you could try doing that with carpet cleaning. It might be a bit harder because it's a very competitive space.
It's a lot of carpet.
Exactly, and it'd probably involve like a franchise model or something like that. But the point is, it seemed like a nice way to start. So once I narrowed it down from there, to get to your other questions about the process, you got to reach out to whoever's listing it. Sometimes it's the owner. Oftentimes it's a business broker. A site I was using a lot was BizBuySell. So it's BizBuySell. And that has a ton of business listings all over the country. And from there, you can also meet brokers who maybe don't have all their listings on there, but it seems like pretty much all publicly listed business listings are on there. But there are also local brokers as well who maybe know someone who's looking to sell but isn't totally listed yet. So it's one way to do it. It's kind of similar to real estate in that way. But from there, you're going to ask whoever's listing it or the owner for information on what the business is doing, the owner's roles, how many employees, what equipment is involved in the sale. Are you selling the brand, or are you just selling a segment of your business? Is this an asset sale versus the company entity itself? All those different considerations. You're just asking for information. They're probably going to ask you for proof of funds or something like that, or how do you plan on purchasing this thing? If you build some good rapport and you decide to move forward and you come off as a reputable buyer, because you are a reputable buyer, then you'll probably get it under contract. Then you'll enter due diligence. You'll ask for more information, probably tax returns for some of these smaller service-based businesses with a couple people involved. Depending on how sophisticated they are, they might not have intense record keeping. The business I bought did pretty much everything electronically, so it's pretty easy to verify some things. And also have got tax returns to double verify it, because if they're lying to the government, that's a problem. Once you verify all the information, you do your inspections, whatever you got to do, kind of depends on the business again, what's involved. From there, during that time, we're going to be looking for financing, assuming you're not buying in cash. In the US, you have things like the SBA program, which allow you to get into businesses for as little as 10% down. So you can finance a lot of the purchase on decent terms. We're talking about 10-year terms in many cases at fixed rates. Or if a significant amount of real estate is involved, you can get that up to a 25-year term, also at fixed rates. So financing options are really great on that side. It does take a while to get an SBA loan, and they don't loan on every sort of business. But then the other way would be to get the money from somewhere else. I actually ended up using a lot of personal loans and then a credit card promo as well for part of it. So it was a bunch of little loans that I combined together into a cash pool, and I'm paying those off now. So there's a lot of ways to do it, and you can get creative. And then of course there's the gold standard, which would be seller financing. If you can get decent terms there, where the seller will actually finance some portion of the purchase and you pay them over time rather than paying them up front, for whatever portion of the deal it is. So not every seller is open to that, but many are, especially if they're looking to retire potentially, and they don't need the cash right away. They might like that sort of annuity style, stretching out the payments. And once you actually get the thing financed, then you obviously close on the business, and then now the business is yours, and you'll see if you bought what you thought you bought pretty quickly. So that's kind of what the overall process looks like. There's a lot of things that can change a deal at any one of those stages, financing being a very big one, I think. But of course, you'll discover lots of stuff during due diligence, or maybe not. I guess that's the overarching process. I don't know, maybe we can unpack something from there.
Yeah, for sure. I think it'd be interesting to dive into. I know you're pretty transparent with more or less all of your numbers on YouTube. Do you mind sharing like just how cheap some of these things were, like what sort of cash flow you were expecting to get versus the price you're paying?
Sure. I mean, I can tell you about the one I got. So I got this business for $172,000. It was a bit under the ask price. So we met in the middle from a number that I first gave. So it was a little back and forth. It had been on the market for a little while, so thought I'd make a fairly, I guess aggressive is the wrong word, but I made, and I don't want to call it a low ball either, but I made a lower offer, and then we met in the middle. But that was $172,000, and that was on cash flow from the previous year of $70,000. So keep in mind also, we had about, we'll call it $60,000 worth of equipment value built in to that purchase price too. So, and that's between trucks, carpet cleaning equipment, supplies, and that sort of stuff. No real estate involved in this one. So if I really needed to liquidate, I have stuff right there to sell too, in addition to the brand value, all the customer contacts and all that stuff. So that's what, a little over 2x free cash flow. When you back out the equipment value, it's under 2x. So
yeah, it's like a 40% yield or something.
Yeah, pretty much, assuming the numbers hold. And I was a little worried because in January and February, it's very slow for carpet and cleaning. So, I'm not seeing those numbers in those first 2 months. But now we've gotten through March, ticket sizes are ramping up. We're getting into spring cleaning, which apparently is a real thing. People do take that very seriously. And we're starting to bring in some more commercial customers as well, which is great. We're really making a push for that. One of the first hires I made on this business was hiring a general manager who's helping me with all that. We're trying to hire out some sales folks now to really try and fill out the capacity that we do have to fulfill all these cleanings. So, but it's good to see the numbers are starting to match up with what I thought I bought. So that's good.
Why do you think these things trade at such monster yields? Is it, sellers are sellers are worried that people could just start a similar business themselves with, you know, someone else could start the same business with less capital, or there's not many buyers out there, or what?
Well, the thing is, take on that. It's not, I'd be careful to compare it to, you know, a publicly traded stock.
Sure.
Because we kind of talked about it earlier, but the you need some sort of active involvement, whether you're hiring someone or you're doing it yourself. So that's a big turnoff for some folks. Sometimes if the size gets to a certain point, it might be too small for like venture capital to worry about it, but too big for some young scrappy entrepreneur to go for it. So that can be awkward as well. Sometimes it might be in a business that's just weird, or the records are terrible, or just, you know, something's off with it. Because a lot of people are, let me tell you, Tom, you can make a lot of money without having basic knowledge of how technology works. So yeah. If you add any sort of technological know-how to this business, you could probably take it to a significantly higher level. That wasn't the case with this business, but just some of the ones you see, like, how are they making this much money with, you know, these systems, or these, or this lack of systems? I mean, it just shows you how you can make good money as long as your service is good. So anyways, but I think that's one, the main reason is just, you're probably going to have some sort of active involvement. It's not as simple as buy and forget 95% of the time, it seems. And also, a lot of these businesses go unsold, a ton of them, apparently. I see something like 90% of businesses don't sell within the first year or something that are listed. I don't know where that number exactly is coming from, but it's a lot that don't sell. And I see listings for a lot of these businesses that are up for a very long time and they don't go anywhere. A lot of people are trying to retire, and there's, I don't know if it's the demographic reversion sort of thing, where we got too many old people, not enough young people to take over those businesses, something like that. I don't know. But a lot of businesses just go unsold. It's not nearly as liquid of a market as, say, homes here in the US, where they're throwing 30-year fixed rate mortgages at them, so, and everyone wants a house. It's just there's like a cultural push towards that rather than buying someone else's business. At least from what I've seen. So I don't know if that answers the question, but it's a lot of these businesses simply go unsold. So you can't really charge a big premium for them because you can just pick one up for a lot cheaper that's not selling anytime soon.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair call. And I imagine like there's just a lot of crap in there as well when
you're looking at
the listings. Would you feel like, what percentage of businesses would you even take more than a 10-second look at when you're going through listings?
That really comes down to industry first. So there's like a ton of restaurants that I'm not even going to bother looking at. And a lot of them are, running a restaurant is a ton of work. I've never run one, but I can tell it's gotta be super tough. You either gotta be super into it, or you're just, this is a pet project and you're not afraid to lose money on it. That's how I view it. But not that you can't make money with it, but it's very difficult compared to some other businesses.
I heard Jeremy Clarkson from Top Gear on his recent show talking about, I forget the percentages, but he was planning to start a restaurant and someone told him, 90% of restaurants fail in the first year or something like that.
Yeah, first 2 years, and I think told them, that. Yeah, I think I've heard something
like
that.
Yeah, he told them, well, his business plan is to be in the 10%. that was the plan. So don't know how that's working out, but sorry, I interrupted you there.
No, yeah. So I wouldn't really take a look at those. I think it comes into industry first. Then from there, if there's just something off about the listing where maybe they're not showing a very important number for some reason, that would be that would give me some pause for, what's going on there. I don't know. It just kind of depends on, I think, first and foremost, what it's in. And then from there, you just take a look at what their advertised numbers are. And I try to ask for some more information from there, mainly about the owner's role and if they have any more detailed financials they can give, or a flyer or something. And then usually from there, you can kind of get to the bottom of it.
Mm-hmm.
Not always.
What do you think of as the main risks when you're going into a deal like this? Is it just that the cash flow is not going to turn up? Is that kind of what it all comes down to? How do you think about that?
I think the main risk is myself. I just make poor business decisions. I, because unless I'm being defrauded, which is a low risk. It is a risk, but it's a low risk. They've proven, you know, this business that I bought has been around since 2016. So they've been operating for a while with just a couple guys. The owner worked part-time in it most of the time. So he was able to make that work and made decent money on it doing that. So as long as I can match that, I should be all right. And if I can do better than that, then great. We can make some more money from there or scale it to a significant level. And that's one of the reasons my first move is to bring on some new leadership with the general manager. I'm still active in the business, but I'm focusing much more on recruiting and trying to build out the team, whereas he is focusing much more on fulfillment and some sales as well. So yeah, really the biggest risk is myself, and I don't want to pretend like, yeah, at a certain point, you really can't point the finger anymore after the first couple months, because it's now your thing, you're running it. And you really, the whole point of buying the business is you're getting a jogging start. Not that it's just going to be autopilot from here. It's more that, okay, we're skipping the initial slog phase of business where you're just trying to get, you know, proof of concept or whatever it is. This one is already operating at a decent level. So first step is just figuring out a way to maintain that. Second step is now to try and improve it. So once you get to that improvement step, it's all on you at that point anyways. So, if a year from now the business goes under, I'd hesitate to blame the seller for giving me a bad thing. Because at that point, I've run it for quite some time. And if I can't figure it out from there, you know, lesson learned, I suppose, or lesson not learned.
Yeah, fair call. It seems like one of the things you've done pretty well out of the gate is start to bring new people into the business or outsource some of the things that you would otherwise be doing. Can you talk us through some of the changes you've made there and I guess how you think about that from a business standpoint around, I suppose it helps with growth and frees up your time, but obviously comes at a cost as well.
Yeah. I've only actually hired one person. We were very close to hiring another one. We had an offer out for a sales guy, which was denied yesterday because he went for another job. Unfortunately, I thought we had something good going, but oh well, on to the next one. But I've only made one hire to this point. And I guess you could say I promoted one of our current technicians. And because he was like a junior technician, been with the business for about 6 months. So promoted him and he's been super happy with that. They do, our two technicians that were with the business when I bought it, they continue to do very good work. So that's great. You could say that's one of the things I was buying is just the solid reputation that the business has. And a lot of that has been driven by these techs who do a great job. So that's been relatively unchanged. But the big hire was hiring a general manager. He actually gets a cut of revenue. So it's a significant amount of money if we were just trying to stop right here. But obviously we're trying to grow. So I think it's totally worth it. I assume he'll be able to add much more than 10% to the business or whatever percent to the business that he'd be getting paid to then, pay for himself in that way. And it also give me some time back too. And that time, like I said, is focused on recruiting and not fulfillment and putting out any fires that we might have or a customer's unhappy about something. So that's kind of how I look at that. And right now, the big focus is trying to build out a sales team. I think focusing on demand is really what I'm trying to do right now. That is customer demand. Get some more demand for the business. We can fulfill it, or we should be able to. And eventually, we won't be able to fulfill it because it's too much. And then we focus back on fulfillment again, get another technician, get another truck, whatever it is. So that's kind of the seesaw battle that you're constantly dealing with. And right now, we got room for more demand. So that's what we're pushing for. And that's where I think going for sales folks. First, makes sense. From there, I guess the next hire would probably be an admin of some sort. I forget, a couple salespeople. Because right now we outsource our kind of scheduling and admin type activities. Picking up the phone is to a third party service that's cheaper than having an employee. But at a certain point, once we have enough demand coming in, it won't make sense for them to do everything. And it'll be better just to have someone in-house, more personal touch anyways. That was something the original owner had set up, and to some pretty significant success. So we've kept that going. But eventually we get someone in-house as well. So I kind of talked about more of what we're trying to do more than what I did. But the big hire was hiring a manager, and he's getting more and more comfortable with things. He sold a couple bigger jobs as well, mainly to commercial customers. So we're trying to get into some chain restaurants, and we've gotten success with one. We just served a chain here in town that now has, or it's a franchise owner who has 4 other locations as well, and he wants us to do those. So that stuff like that is going to pay off in a big way if we can get more recurring commercial sort of revenue. And that's where having someone just focusing a lot more on sales would be really excellent, just to keep pushing that along full time rather than just the manager and I doing it very part time while we're worrying about a bunch of other things. But such is small business. You're wearing a bunch of hats, especially early on. And as you grow, you can specialize more as you can afford to. You have enough demand for each particular position that would make sense. That's how I view hiring.
Nice. Maybe just one last question on sort mm-hmm. of the purchasing process. I mean, do you think having a law background helped you in any way with going through this process?
Yeah, I mean, I think any perspective helps, really. I don't want to say my law perspective is any better than some other perspective. That, you know, as long as you're doing interesting things, I suppose, and you're being reflective on them, that's going to be helpful. I was definitely very comfortable with contract language, drafting employment agreements, and all that stuff. I'm not an employment attorney or anything, but you know, I'm dealing with contracts all the time, so I have some idea of what to work for or what to look for. I'm not intimidated by looking at the numbers, and that's a lot from this whole stock game that we both have been playing for a while. And you certainly turned me on to stock value investing. I was kind of doing it with real estate, and you kind of opened my eyes like, oh, you can do it with stocks too. I'm like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Now you're doing it with private businesses.
Yeah. Now we're doing that to private businesses. It's all this, all the fundamentals are very similar. So I was very comfortable just kind of looking at a deal. Initially from real estate, then from real estate and stocks, now real estate, stocks, and now businesses, or private businesses, which is really just another form of a stock, I suppose. So I think that was what was especially valuable, was just doing deal analysis at some level for quite some time now. Just makes me very comfortable looking at the numbers. That's probably how I'd answer that. Deal analysis first, legal background stuff second. Both were helpful, of course. And if I had some carpet cleaning experience before this, I would have been helpful too, but I didn't. So, oh well.
I can come later.
Yeah. Well, I've learned quite a bit, and I now see the world through a floor lens. It's kind of weird. I'll go into places and notice tile where I never noticed it before. Hey, we should go clean that tile, or we're at a restaurant. I never realized how grout lines are not supposed to be black most of the time. That is dirt and grime that needs to be washed out. So, and that's what we can do.
I like it. I know one of the things you've mentioned to me in the past is that I guess your day job in real estate, being a real estate attorney, is sort of desensitized you from very large numbers in a way. Do you think that?
I guess so.
Yeah. You think that made you comfortable with, you know, putting hundreds of thousands of dollars to work and not really being particularly worried about it?
I don't know if it was from work specifically. I don't know. I'm kind of biased in that answer. So maybe it did make a difference. But I think what makes a bigger difference, at least what I think about more, is I want to get to a much greater level than, you know, a couple hundred grand. I want to get to, I mean, at least a few million dollars in business worth within the portfolio at some point in the foreseeable future. Foreseeable being maybe not the best word, but in the next however many years, I think reaching a few million dollars in the portfolio makes sense and is definitely achievable. So from that perspective, should I really get super hung up on a couple hundred grand? I don't want to be reckless by any means, but that's what's kind of desensitized me. It's more where I'm trying to go, and what would someone who's trying to get to that position, what would someone in that position actually worry about? Would they worry about 100 grand, or would they try to make the million-dollar decision? I'm not saying I'm making million-dollar decisions, but I'm trying to head towards that direction. So I think that's what made a much bigger difference there.
Got it. Jack, this wouldn't be a Jack Duffley podcast if we didn't speak about debt I would say. We
it's unfortunate that's the reputation, but all right.
Yeah, we had some interesting comments on Twitter. I was trying to collect some questions for this episode, and I just happened to call you Jack, Mr. Business Duffley, as a random nickname I just assigned to you as I wrote that tweet. And we had a couple of comments saying more like Mr. Debt or Mr. Good Credit Score.
I saw that one.
Yeah, you're pretty transparent on YouTube about, I guess, like your current balance sheet and how much debt you've got. And I guess relative to your assets, it is a pretty substantial amount. And
it is.
At least as most people would probably view it. Yeah, I think you've mentioned already in this podcast at least one point about being cautious about overextending yourself as well. I guess, how do you think about the use of debt? Presumably having a reasonable income, you know, relative to that amount of debt makes you more comfortable as well. I guess, what are some of the things flying through your head with
where
you're at in that department at the moment?
Getting right at it, Tom. Let's see. Relative to my asset values, it is a lot, and I don't like having it there. So I'm trying to push back on it quite a bit. However, if I'm able to land another great business deal, especially with like super favorable financing, like a seller financing over some term, I'm not going to shy away from the deal right now. However, in the meantime, I do want to get rid of some of those loans, especially the shorter term loans. Definitely the ones that I used to finance this previous purchase. A lot of those are pretty high interest. So my goal this year is to pay off $200,000 in debt. However, with the asterisk that if I, find another deal that requires me to take out some more debt, you know, I'll still do it. I don't want to say no to a great deal. But I'm trying to be a bit more hesitant and more selective. But again, part of the reason I sold off the stocks. And once my Indianapolis property sells, I should have around $200,000 to $250,000 in cash sitting there if I don't deploy it anywhere, which gives me a pretty long runway for all the payments I got to make. And that's assuming none of my 30-year fixed rate mortgages are being paid by rental income. Got a couple of those. And that is another thing I will say on that, that the term on a large chunk of my debt is long-term 30-year fixed rate mortgages. So the payments really aren't that high. And one of them's at 2.99% interest. So like, you know, oh shucks. But and then But if I ever needed to sell, yes, I don't have a ton of equity, breathing space, which is a bit nerve-wracking. So I want to be careful with that. And that's a big reason I'm focusing on paying off those the non-mortgage debt right now, just to try and make some space there. And then when a great deal comes around, I can still go for that. I'll have some more equity to work with anyways. Just trying to be a bit more selective in where I'm throwing debt, because I did spend quite a bit on real estate in the past few years, which has been great, but real estate's getting very expensive, even especially now with interest rates ticking way up and prices not really coming way down yet. So I just want to be very, very careful taking out more. We're definitely far from being in trouble, but you know, trouble can come knocking pretty quickly. So always trying to keep an eye on that. I don't want to be this leveraged for forever, of course.
Yeah. So is that one of the main reasons why you're looking to sell a property and why you move some money out of stocks?
To
deleverage a little?
Well, selling the property, so I look at it this way. So that Indianapolis house, first off, I can get way more than I realized I could afford it because prices have just run up so much in the last couple of years. I bought it for $85,000 in 2020. And that was July 2020. So while the supernova was just kind of starting in the financial markets. And so I bought it for 85. By the time that this little rehab we're doing is done with it, getting it ready for sale, I will have put around an extra $30,000 into it over those 2.5 years. And right now I could probably get almost $170,000 for it, which is not a bad return in just a couple of years.
Yeah.
And for something that I didn't expect to do that. And that doesn't include all the rental income that I had during those few years as well. There wasn't any debt on that one. So selling that will free up a bunch of cash. Oh, but anyways, before I get to that, so if I held it right now, let's say it's worth 160, 150 to be more conservative if we can't get the 170, the one very close by I just sold for that. So I think we can get pretty close. I could hold it for 150 to keep the numbers a bit easy. And let's just say in a very great year, I make $10,000 in cash flow on that property. Probably wouldn't be that high, but just to keep the number simple. So, you know, $10,000 on $150,000, it's not terrible for real estate. But if I roll that $150,000 into 2x cash flow, 2x times free cash flow business, that's $75,000 in cash flow. Yeah, there's risk. I have to run it and everything. But it's just a lot more attractive right now because I'm trying to boost that cash flow up. I'm trying to grow this business portfolio. And that could involve just reinvesting into the current business. So that's kind of how I'm looking at that. And that's a big reason I'm doing it. It's just, why would I leave it in something that's a comparatively low multiple when I have all this equity there anyways and can get a pretty good price for it when I could just roll it into something else? That's the main driver there. And plus, less things to worry about, I guess, in the meantime.
Got it. I've actually seen a couple of YouTube comments suggesting you should do this exact thing on your monthly net worth series and that type of thing over on your YouTube channel. Is this something you were already thinking about? Have the YouTube comments pushed you in this direction?
I always appreciate the candor of folks in the comments. Yeah. It's good at getting more perspectives in there. I definitely was thinking about selling stocks for quite some time now. I've been consolidating my stock portfolio over quite a few months now anyways. I went down from 20 something holdings down to like 9, I think is what I ended up at within my taxable stock portfolio, not my retirement accounts. Those are all index funds. The safety net against my own stupidity is what I like to refer to that as. So I was already kind of looking into doing that. The real estate stuff I wasn't thinking about too much, but then just as chance had it, we had like a mold issue in one of the bathrooms in the Indianapolis property. The tenant was on a month-to-month lease, so we cut it off right there. We're like, okay, we'll fix this issue. And that kind of got me thinking, okay, we're going to spend a bunch of money on this turn. It was a lot more money than I thought we were going to spend, maybe 10 to 15,000. Then it turned into 20 to 25,000. I'm like, ooh, that's a lot more than I was expecting.
Real estate things.
Yeah, right. And cost inflation as well too. I'm still based in 2018 numbers or something. it's already like a lot more expensive. I'm like, dang, this is really annoying. And I'm like stressing about this. I wasn't stressing too hard. We have reserves set aside, and my property manager actually offers to finance the rehab as well. And then they would pay it they would take the payment out of rent. So like, okay, I could kind of finance it without any problem if I wanted to do that too. But I was just thinking more, okay, why don't I actually just ask the agent who sold me the property a couple of years ago, what do you think I get for it? And then I saw the numbers and I'm like, oh, okay. I have not been paying that close attention to what I could get for it. So maybe all these people who are saying to sell that were right. I sold the stocks already, so now I'm moving to sell that property. So that's it. It's not that it's a bad rental. It's been a solid rental, even with these hiccups included. But that's going to happen in real estate. You're going to have to do a major turn. This is the same tenant we had since we bought the property, so we didn't have any vacancy for 2.5 years, which is solid. And this is the first time, and it's almost like a delayed flip, I guess, if you want to look at it that way. I suppose the comments got me thinking about it more than I already was. it did make sense given that I was trying to do that with stocks. Why not do it with real estate as well? Not that I'm trying to liquidate the whole portfolio, since I still have three other properties, if you include my house.
Yeah. And I should, we've given it a couple of shout outs already, but if people want to hear like the nitty gritty details on this month to month, Jack has a great series over on his YouTube channel, which I'll link in the show notes.
Thank you, Tom.
Definitely go and check that out.
I agree.
Yeah. And I always really enjoy the change in like music style when you go from assets to liabilities.
I'm glad someone enjoys that.
that's great. I always look forward to that. It sounds like it's really just come down to like basically where can you get the best return on capital? Where's the highest cash flow yield essentially? And you just try to allocate more and more
the simplest way to put it, with the added benefit of education here. And I find it very interesting. It's fun in a certain type of way. And it's just, it's satisfying, like trying to build something as well. So I wouldn't do this just to chase the dollars, because it would be extremely exhausting otherwise. There are lots of ways to make money. This is one of them. And one that I think is pretty scalable, all things considered. And plus you're getting equity in these businesses too. So, those are some of the main reasons, but yeah, it is just ultimately the first step is that it's a lot cheaper, and then all these other secondary benefits come along with it too.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a couple more questions on the small business purchase. Mm-hmm. Are there any like major unexpected things that have come out of the deal that you've, this sort of first deal that you've made so far? Any major lessons that you'll take into the next one, or has it been about as smooth sailing as you could hope for?
It's a good question. Some major lessons here. One thing that's definitely been reinforced has been the importance of incentives, and not that we've had a big problem there, but a lot of employees in this space are paid hourly, which I don't think makes a ton of sense for home services most of the time, because then you're incentivizing them to actually work more slowly through the process, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So our guys are on commission, and they actually enjoy that, because they're actually incentivized to upsell as well. And we have a lot of little items we can upsell too. And a lot of times the guys can add a couple $100 to the ticket price right there, and that's more commission for them too. So everyone's kind of aligned in the right direction. So that's been very reinforced. I try to focus on that with how we're hiring folks as much as possible. If you show me instead of show, I'll show you the outcome. Charlie Munger, always a great one to remember. So that's one thing. Another thing is just the importance of punctuality. It's the simplest point, but it's the hardest point at the same time. If you can get that done, you're going to be in great shape in pretty much any business. If you can show up on time and just do the things you say you're going to do, people will be, at least they won't be mad. They'll probably be pretty happy. Worst case, they won't care. Oh, well, fine. But if you're not there, that's when people get very angry. Or if you're not there when you say you're going to be there, or if you do the work poorly. And occasionally that will happen. Maybe there's a mix up with scheduling, or someone shows up late and then we have to put out the fire, offer a discount and all that. Just trying to make the customers happy. We've gotten some 5-star reviews out of people who were very angry and were like, okay, sorry. Well, we'll get back out there. We'll redo this or offer a discount, wherever it is. And they end up giving us a 5-star review out of it, because it shows that we cared about it. And that's just been totally reinforced since I started this, just making sure that you're actually thinking about the customers and trying to make them happy. Within reason, of course. You don't want to give everything away for free, but in times where you really did mess something up, you didn't show up on time, you know, you want to make that right. And actually, in one of the franchise restaurant I mentioned earlier was they had another company doing other work there too the previous day, and I guess the on-site manager there was like complimenting our guys when they were there that, oh, thank you for showing up on time. Like, we were doing a bunch of work on this restaurant, and like the previous two companies, one didn't even show up and the other was like 3 hours late. And it just shows you how weirdly uncommon that is, just to show up on time. So if you can find that, like, run with it. Cause if, customers notice that, and that's what customers want. So, doing the blocking and tackling correctly, as a lot of people say, is what really will move the needle in a big way. Not so much the flashy systems and all that. You just got to show up. If you can show up, you'll be in a great spot.
Very cool.
That's my 3-month business wisdom right there.
Nice. Yeah. So it sounds like no major surprises, really, like expecting 70 grand cash flow in this massive hole that's emerged in that. It's really reinforcing things that you already had in your mind.
I will say the one surprise has been insurance is expensive. Like, my goodness, insurance costs have run up, especially auto insurance. That was a surprise. And I saw what insurance costs before. It's not like exorbitantly higher, but it's significantly higher. And I was like, ouch, had to put out quite a few thousands in that first month just towards insuring the business and the vehicles. And having some younger drivers doesn't help your premiums either. But sure. Man, it's for, you know, a 10-year-old van, you're paying multiple thousands in insurance when it's all said and done. A couple of 10-year-old vans, I'll say. Very expensive. So that was a surprise. Be ready for that. Try to get quotes early in the process before you buy the business. I was getting them very towards the end. And I got some of that insurance re-rate shock.
The Buff Dog must be having a good year, I guess, with his insurance company.
Yeah, I looked at Byberk because they do a lot of business insurance, and significantly higher than the one we're using. But theirs was in line with what others were offering.
Got it.
But yeah.
So what's the long term goal here with the businesses, Jack? Is it to build the Berkshire of Houston steam cleaning? What's the plan?
I mean that'd be pretty nice if I got to that level, but
we're gonna spec this thing.
Or? I think that ecosystem I kind of alluded to earlier is probably the achievable, attractive long term goal, something like that. Uh-huh. Where got a few kind of adjacent industries that, or even just one industry with multiple segments of that industry, have a few businesses serving those, or at least a business or two that serve multiple segments. And that could be a nice way to not only throw off a bunch of cash flow, but also you have the ability to serve hard assets like real estate or something like that. Or the businesses can also serve each other as well to get costs down. That would be pretty nice to have, but that I don't want to get ahead of myself because you got to get the one right first. So I'm trying not to go crazy, but definitely being pretty aggressive compared to maybe someone who's a little more seasoned than this, perhaps. But you know, starting from a pretty small base, so you got to be kind of aggressive, I guess, if you're trying to really grow the thing. But either way, it's just putting pieces of the puzzle together, and that has been fun. So. Yep. Once it stops being fun, maybe my answer will change.
Fair enough. Jack, let's maybe take a few questions from Twitter to wrap this thing up. We've got a lot of replies to this tweet of mine for questions for Jack, which are just, they're just more comments than questions. So we might get your take on a few of these.
Sure.
But we do have a couple of questions though. One from Matt, I guess we've probably already answered this question with selling quite a few of your stocks, but is he still buying SNBR? Is that Sleep Number stock?
Sleep Number. Well, can't say I am. The caveat here is that I'm not selling these stocks because of some fundamental change. Just, you know, it's the timing of it. I'm selling them all. So I'm an indiscriminate stock seller right now. It's not a market timing thing either.
Fair, cool. We had one from Jonas, I suppose that's pronounced. Apologies if not. I think, again, we've already covered this a fair amount, but thoughts on returns from investing in real estate versus private businesses versus the stock market. We already kind of covered that.
Yeah, I think we did. Yeah, but okay. Yeah, one thing I will say about real estate, and I guess with all this, is debt does change the equation. It adds risk, but that can pump up returns. And that's one of the best things that real estate has going for it, but also small businesses as well. You can get some pretty good financing terms there. You can turn a not so great deal into a really great one, depending on the kind of financing you can get, especially on that seller financing sort of thing. If you can get some really solid terms for someone who's itching to sell and isn't too worried about getting the cash right there, they just want to remove the headache of running the business. So that can really change the equation for all those things.
Yep, fair, cool. This is really one of those comments rather than questions, but Brad Kellner, stock compounder. This guy's going place, fire emoji. What do you think about that?
Appreciate it, Brad.
Brad's always building everyone up. I really enjoy it. Again, I think we've covered this question, but interesting one here from Shane. How old is Jack Duffley? Looks like a 15-year-old with the business acumen and experience of a 70-year-old.
Yeah, I don't know about the experience, but it's maybe the attitudes. My friends have been joking that I've been joking as well, that I've been 45 since I was, you know, 15. So makes sense.
Yeah.
I was born an old man.
I think that's more of a compliment, isn't it? Like, yeah,
I don't mind it. Yeah, it's pretty accurate. So,
yeah, there you go. Jack, that's really all the questions we've got from over on Twitter. This has been a lot of fun. It's been good to pick your brain on the private business buying and some of the various things you're doing with your investing and where you want to head. So last question from me, for those people that somehow aren't following you, they certainly should be. So where can they go and where can they go and check out more of what you're doing?
Sure. I'm Jack Duffley, I think everywhere. The main sort of spot to go probably would be YouTube. Trying to be more active on Twitter as well. I've gotten a lot more active in the last year. But I'm at Jack Duffley everywhere. If you go to jackduffley.com/links, that's links plural. That should take you to all my stuff. I appreciate it very much, Tom. It's always a pleasure talking with you, and we'll be doing that every week for the foreseeable future as well, and just as we have been over on Punch Card Investing. That's another place you can find me as well. You can find Tom over there. If you're the one person who hasn't subscribed to Punch Card Investing, go check that out as well. It's in podcast form too. So for all those people who are anti-YouTube for whatever it is, it's in podcast form too. So check out Punch Card Investing. Tom and I will be over there. But appreciate it as always, Dad Tom.
Thanks very much, Jack. And for those that, again, somehow aren't following Punch Card Investing, we're actually going to be live about 2 hours after recording this or 3 hours after recording this, but you will hear this much later than that Punch Card episode. And Jack is our very brilliant host over on Punch Card Investing, which I often have to replace you when you're away and don't do anywhere near as good a job. I struggle with working out all the StreamYard controls and all that.
It is a challenge. I appreciate that, but... I don't know about brilliant. I do try. I've had some practice. It's really the practice that makes the difference.
For sure. Well, Jack, this was a lot of fun. We'll have to get you back much sooner than 2 years later next time. But
I'd be down for it.
I hope people enjoyed this one.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Jack. Cheers.